You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, good morning, everyone, and welcome to Brookings. My name is Elizabeth Ferris. I'm a senior fellow in foreign policy here at Brookings and have been working on issues of displacement and humanitarian crises since for a long, long time. You know, we're delighted to have this program today focusing particularly on Syrian refugees, looking at the regional dimensions, both in the neighboring countries, broader Europe, and the United Nations, as well as the U.S. This is organized by the Center on the U.S. and Europe, which Kamal Qureshi, my colleague, directs the Turkey project there. Syrian refugees have suddenly become front-page news. You can't turn on the television or open a news magazine without seeing a report. And yet some 4 million people have been displaced in the region, and we are looking now at the beginning of the fifth year of this displacement. Kamal and I have been working on Syrian displacement for several years. I went back and looked at the title of the report we issued 2 years ago, and it was called Syrian Crisis: Massive Displacement, Dire Needs, and a Shortage of Solutions. At that time, there were 2 million Syrian refugees. Today, that number has doubled, but the title we chose in 2013 certainly applies to the situation today. Kamal and I are working on a larger study, which will be published later this year, looking at all the dimensions, or as many dimensions as we can fit in, of the Syrian displacement crisis, issues around safe zones and cross-border assistance, and what's happening in Lebanon, Jordan, Turkey, and other countries. Just to make a few general remarks, first of all, I think you all know that although we talk about this as a humanitarian crisis, there are no humanitarian solutions. In the absence of a political solution, humanitarians can only do so much. It's kind of like the Band-Aid approach to dealing with people who are hurting without addressing the cause of the crisis. Only a political solution inside Syria will reverse, or has the possibility of reversing, this humanitarian crisis. Secondly, if you look at this from a global perspective, Syrian displacement has been massive, it has been rapid, and it is a dynamic process. We're not talking today about people who are displaced inside Syria, although the numbers are almost twice as many as refugees who have crossed international borders. People who are displaced inside the country, almost 8 million, we think, although we really don't know. But people who are displaced within the borders of their country are likely more vulnerable to violence. They're closer to the conflicts. Accessing them has been a nightmare for humanitarians working either cross-border or from Damascus. And internal displacement is related to refugee flows. I remember a couple of years ago talking with an official of the Jordanian Foreign Ministry who said, Jordan is stop number four for the refugees we're seeing. Most of them have been displaced two or three times inside the country before they make it to our borders. The impact on host countries and host communities has been tremendous. Kamal will talk about some of the impact on Turkey, but I would say that, you know, certainly the impact in countries such as Jordan and Lebanon have been monumental. And many of the governments of these countries, as we heard yesterday at the UN General Assembly, feel that their needs and concerns have been ignored until suddenly it becomes an issue when the refugees begin to arrive in large numbers in Europe. I just want to highlight the important role of education. I mean, education is often seen as kind of a soft issue, kind of a social service approach. And yet, when you look at prolonged displacement of Syrians in the region, if education isn't taken seriously, there are long-term consequences for the eventual development of Syria, for the host countries, for the refugees themselves. The loss of human capital is enormous when you see thousands and thousands and hundreds of thousands of school-aged children who are sitting and waiting for something to happen. The format this morning will be that Kamal will do the amazing task of presenting our research in 10 to 12 minutes. Kamal Qureshi is a senior fellow here at Brookings who has worked on issues of Turkey and Turkish foreign policy and Turkish asylum policy earlier at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul. He'll be followed by Simon Hinshaw, who is the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration, PRM as it's often known. Simon is a career Foreign Service officer who's worked in many different parts of the world. You have the bio, so I'm just giving you a few high points. This will be followed by Greg Maniatis, who works for the Migration Policy Institute in New York, particularly on European migration issues. And he's an advisor to Peter Sutherland, the Special Representative on Migration. And finally, we'll hear from Alar Olyum, who is a visiting fellow here at Brookings. He has long years of experience working with the European Union and some of its institutions. He'll be speaking in his personal capacities today so that he can be a little bit more frank. Anyway, thank you very much. We'll start with Kamal, and then we'll have a chance for questions from the audience. Thank you.
Thank you, Beth, and thank you to my panelists, too, for joining us today, as well as thank you to you all. As Beth has pointed out, we've been working on this topic for some time. Actually, we were on field trips in October 2013 in Turkey, but Beth had also visited Lebanon. And we were back there in June 2015. Beth has been to Lebanon, and I will shortly be traveling to Jordan. What we've been aiming to do is to examine how the Syrian displacement crisis is impacting on the major hosting countries in the neighborhood, but also examine and discuss with people in the region what are the challenges and the weaknesses that the humanitarian system is facing as a result of this. When we first visited some of these countries in October 2013, there were only 2 million refugees, and by now their numbers have increased to 4 million. In the case of Turkey, it was just 600,000 refugees, a third of them in refugee camps. Today, there's more than 2 million registered refugees, while one-fifth of them are actually in refugee camps. At the time, most of the displacement overwhelmingly was provoked by the regime in Damascus, but today there's a lot of displacement that is taking place as a function of the fighting amongst the opposition groups, but especially the brutality of the Islamic State in large parts of Syria. Maybe most importantly, I would argue that there is despair. And today it would be very difficult to understand this sudden influx of growing number of Syrian refugees into the European Union. I would argue that it's being driven by despair, the despair resulting from not having a solution to the root cause of that displacement. What I'd like to do is make just a few remarks on comparing 2013-15 from the perspective of Turkey, the impact that they have had on Turkey, the question of international solidarity and burden sharing, and finally a couple of concluding remarks. One big difference between then and today is that the composition of the Syrian refugee population has changed significantly. Back in October 2013, it was mostly Sunni Arabs with small numbers of Alawites and Turkoman. Today, there's a big diversity. There's large numbers of Kurds, some of them coming from Syria, others from Iraq, as well as Yazidis, Christians, and Assyrians, in many ways complicating the management of the refugee crisis. Turkey today, like in 2013, continues to maintain an open-door policy in principle with some challenges and complications, difficulties, but the cost of managing this refugee crisis, which has now reached, according to the Turkish government sources, $7 billion, is beginning to strain the country's resources. Public opinion pressures are increasing, even though officials are saying maybe this is very important in terms of the United States' growing willingness to take an increasing number of Syrian refugees. Even though officials are underlining that there is very little criminality amongst Syrian refugees, the perceptions are not along those lines, that the society thinks that they are heavily involved in criminality, and political developments are being affected too. Thirdly, compared to October 2013, this issue of safe zones is coming up much more frequently. It was first highlighted in July 2012 when the government had unilaterally put a red line saying if it goes beyond 100,000, we will start seeking a safe zone in Syria for refugees. Luckily, so far, this has not happened. On the good side, compared to 2013, there is much more cooperation with international agencies, but also international non-governmental organizations. Last comparative observation, there is recognition that these refugees in Turkey have to be integrated, and integration has already started. The Turkish Prime Minister has just spoken in New York, part and parcel of the General Assembly meeting there. He has not put the accent on this aspect of a reality we thought we observed, and that reality was highlighted, flagged out to us by officials, not just by NGO activists and experts there. What are the impacts that the Syrian refugees are having on Turkey? The most visible one, we could say, is the economic one. Particularly in the regions close to the border area, prices have been increasing, especially rent for accommodation, but also wages have been coming down, particularly in the informal sector of the economy that is driving some of the resentment and the kind of public opinion survey results that I alluded to earlier on. Yet there is the other side of the medallion that rarely gets recognized and mentioned, especially in government circles, is that the presence of refugees now entering their fifth year in Turkey is also generating economic activity. As international agencies arrive into the area together with non-governmental organizations and sort of set up shops, they are employing Turkish people in the region. Then some of the Syrian business people that have come over have brought over their capital, setting up businesses, restaurants, but also getting involved in foreign trade. Amazingly, Turkish foreign trade, especially exports to Syria, not surprisingly, collapsed as the crisis erupted. But recently, that export has picked up because these businessmen continue to trade, if I understand correctly, not only just with the areas that are controlled by opposition groups, but also a proper Syria in the sense of under the control of Assad. That needs to be borne in mind. Social impact is very critical, and that's where there are some disappointing challenges, especially, for example, child marriages, religious marriages, which are not registered, and in those cases, women are not well protected under the law. And the most disappointing aspect of this impact is child labor and prostitution. Lastly, we go into some detail in the report. We must also take into consideration the political impact that the presence of Syrians are having in Turkey. Some of you may be following that there has been a lot of violence recently in Turkey between the Kurdish separatist group, terrorist group called the PKK, and the security forces. I won't go into the details of it. I wouldn't want to overwhelm you and scare you away. But it would not be possible to understand the eruption of that violence without factoring into the equation the presence of these refugees. Questions of international solidarity and burden sharing. Protection of refugees is recognized as an international responsibility, not solely the responsibility of hosting countries. And burden sharing is very critical to it. And often it is seen as the resettlement of some of the refugees, particularly the vulnerable ones, and the extension of humanitarian assistance, not to mention, of course, trying hard to find a political solution. Today's European refugee crisis, I think, cannot be understood without recognizing how poor that international solidarity and burden sharing has been. The United Nations High Commissioner, or the High Commissioner for Refugees, Antonio Guterres, has been running around the world, especially the West, literally pleading with the leadership of member countries of the European Union and Western countries, asking for resettlement quotas, and also for humanitarian, for meeting the budget for humanitarian assistance. That's where the picture has been very disappointing. He's asked for 130,000 places. These countries have come forward with 100,000 places, but as the crisis erupted and reached its peak by August, there were only 9,000 resettlements that had actually occurred since the beginning of the Syrian crisis. And the way I see it, wrongly or rightly, is that the despair I have made references to has kicked in, and refugees have started to seek the services of human smugglers, unscrupulous human smugglers, rather than look forward to a mechanism run by governments and international agencies to resettle them. Very quickly, concluding remarks. As Beth has highlighted, the root cause of this displacement is a political one. In the last couple of days, it looks like there is some movement taking place in that respect. Time will tell whether there will actually be a diplomatically negotiated solution that will emerge. However, we have been told in the area by officials, by experts, by NGO activists, that they don't see these people being able to return in 15, 20 years. There is that reality that needs to be borne in mind. A second point, as far as conclusions go, yesterday the idea of safe zones have again been brought up. Actually, today some of you might have seen it in the Washington Post that there were references to retired General David Petraeus at a Senate testimony making references to safe zones. But we, together with Beth and together with many other experts in the area of humanitarian assistance and refugee protection, we feel that the idea of a safe zone, in the light of at least what happened in Srebrenica, is not a particularly wise one, and may make refugees and displaced people even more vulnerable. Third quick observation is that although there is a recognition, a widely shared recognition, including among bureaucrats and officials in Turkey, that Syrian refugees are there to stay, there is still not a comprehensive policy to address the challenges of integrating them. That made references to education. There are some very positive and promising steps that are being taken, but there is also the issue of access to the labor market. Before the elections in June in Turkey, there was on the floor of the parliament a law that would have been, that might have made this possible, but with the political developments in Turkey, this is on a standby right now. My final observation is that the international community will need to come forward with greater support. And I just read the United Nations Secretary General's speech yesterday. There's a lot that is promising there. And I understand on the 30th of September, there's going to be a major meeting at the United Nations to try to address not just the Syrian displacement crisis, but also the broader migration challenges. And I will be keeping my fingers crossed that that solidarity can be mobilized out of that meeting. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good morning. Let me start by thanking Brookings for hosting us today, and Kamal and Elizabeth for your thoughtful remarks, your excellent report, my co-panelists. Pleasure to be here with you. But most especially, let me thank all of you for being here today. It's a great turnout. Hope you have some great questions to ask us. The new Brookings report, Not Likely to Go Home, discusses the need for burden sharing, more support for education, and the importance of expanding legal work opportunities for Syrians in Turkey. These are issues that are priorities for both the United States and Turkey. The report also deals with the challenging concept of integration, one that asks that countries that host so many Syrians, particularly Turkey, go even further to move beyond providing protection to providing an enduring home. The authors helpfully point towards a way of viewing integration as a solution, a mechanism that might serve to help refugees cope, adjust, and even thrive in Turkey. The report notes that ensuring the integration of the refugees would be a win-win for all involved, Syria, Turkey, and the international community. Refugees are dynamic, motivated, passionate people who can give more back to countries hosting them than many would ever have imagined. The recent outpouring of interest and support for Syrian refugees all over our country and globally has been incredibly moving. This interest has translated into increased pledges and contributions towards humanitarian appeals by countries and private donors worldwide. More is needed, but this is an important start. According to UNHCR, it has also resulted in 11 new European member states participating in the refugee resettlement process for the first time. In addition to the horror of war in Syria, we now observe daily the plight of refugees fleeing to European countries and are reminded of the need to redouble our effort to provide humanitarian assistance in regional countries of first asylum and inside Syria. This new funding, which includes assistance for migrants and refugees in Syria, Lebanon, Turkey, Jordan, Egypt, and in Europe, brings the total U.S. humanitarian assistance in response to this conflict to more than $1.6 billion this fiscal year 2015, and over $4.5 billion since the start of the crisis. The funding supports the operations of the United Nations, including UNHCR, UNICEF, and other international and non-governmental organizations, which also includes local organizations. It provides shelter, water, medical care, food, legal assistance, mental health services, vaccinations, spaces for children to play, protection, and other necessary goods and services to millions of people suffering inside Syria and nearly 4 million refugees from Syria in the region. Education remains a top priority for the United States throughout the region. In Turkey, we're supporting Syrian refugees through second shift classes, new schools housed in mobile facilities, community-run schools, and language classes. In less than 2 weeks, U.S. Ambassador to Turkey, John Bass, will join our Assistant Secretary for Population, Refugees, and Migration, Ann Richard, to open a new school in Adana that U.S. funds support through UNICEF. The school will educate more than 2,000 kids returning to study, allow Syrian teachers to return to their profession, and help ease the burden on the host community. The school will also provide an opportunity for Syrian children to study Turkish, helping them interact with their peers and preparing them to better integrate in a community that may be their home for the foreseeable future. This is a model we have supported all over Turkey. UNICEF has already set up 13 of these schools with our funding. Refugee resettlement is another important means of creating durable solutions for some of the most vulnerable. As Secretary Kerry recently announced, the United States is increasing our overall resettlement numbers from 70,000 in fiscal year 2015 to 85,000 in fiscal year 2016, and is committed to raising that number to 100,000 the following year. At least 10,000 of those to be admitted in fiscal year 2016 will be Syrians, compared with only 1,700 this year. In the United States, refugee resettlement has been part of our humanitarian assistance toolbox since 1975, and the United States has been the leader in refugee resettlement, welcoming more than 3 million refugees for resettlement into our country. Our experience with integrating refugees into our society has been overwhelmingly positive. Refugees enrich our communities, they share our values, and they are a boon to our economy. The private sector also has a powerful role to play in addressing the needs in the region. Companies such as Google and TripAdvisor have taken the initiative to match individual donor funding, and we are hoping that other businesses, both U.S.-owned and regional, can offer technology and other services to help students get an education, meet health needs, and connect refugees to available services. The report raises valid concerns with the idea of establishing a safe zone in northern Syria as a place that could be used for the voluntary repatriation of Syrians living in Turkey. We all want Syrians to have the right to voluntarily return when the time is right and when they are ready, but the practicality of securing the zone is extremely challenging, and providing such protection is crucial to ensuring that any safe zone does not become a magnet for attack by regime or by extremist forces. I again want to thank Brookings and my fellow participants, as well as all of you, for being here. I'm heartened by the myriad of academics, practitioners, business people, government officials, and individuals like you who want the same for Syrians. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Simon. Now to Greg Montes from the Migration Policy Institute. Greg?
Hi, thanks, Beth. Thanks, Kamal, and thanks to all of you. I want to touch on three areas in my 6 or 7 minutes of remarks. One is to give you a brief sense of the European context in its broader setting. The second is to discuss essentially why Europe has failed to act effectively this year. And the third is to see what the international reaction has been to the crisis in Syria in terms of displacement, and to look a little bit ahead of what that reaction might be. So the first point is that this is the third major crisis for Europe in the past few years. I have been on the front lines of all three for reasons I won't explain. One is the Greek debt crisis. The other is the Russia-Georgia-Ukraine crisis. And this is now the refugee migration crisis of 2015. Of the three, this is by far the most dangerous and divisive that Europe is facing. In part, that's because it's a cumulative effect of the three, but there's other reasons which I won't get into. But essentially, what is happening now is that the limits of European shared sovereignty have been reached. We're now touching on issues of finances, foreign policy, and identity, and there is not a willingness to share those right now. So it is a very dangerous moment for Europe. Interstate relations are very tense amongst the member states. And domestic polarization is increasing, both on the left, but especially on the right. In Sweden, you have a far-right party, which was at 10-12% in January. It's now at 25%, and it is the leading party in Sweden today. So all those factors are playing into this crisis right now and making it potentially quite explosive in terms of Europe's future. In that context, you would think that perhaps the EU would mobilize. It hasn't. And it's worth thinking about why that is. So if there were an earthquake in Pakistan, you would have emergency relief. There would be tents set up. There would be facilities. Instead, you spent the summer seeing people trekking across Greek islands because there were no reception facilities. The European Union, the wealthiest collection of countries in the history of the world, could not bring itself to supply Greece and Italy earlier with what is needed to quell the chaos, to reduce this picture of people staggering onto the shore and dragging themselves across islands. And that did a lot of damage in terms of public trust in European governments. Europe had a relocation policy, which it proposed on May 14th. That has been the topic of conversation all summer. And yet, this plan to relocate tens of thousands of asylum seekers from Greece and Italy, to this day, does not have an operational component to it that would be nearly sufficient to launch it in the short term. So 5 months later, the European Union does not have the detailed planning to do what is its signature policy. So that inaction, which we can go into detail during the discussion, has had one other major side effect, which is that it's let the rest of the world off the hook. So the Syrian crisis, as Kamal pointed out, the displacement crisis, is a global responsibility. There is some geographic factor, but the bottom line is the international community is responsible for those who are refugees all over the world. Europe, because of its proximity, could have taken the leadership, and it didn't, and it allows other countries to sit back. So why the EU avoided action, I think, is relevant also because you're starting to see the same reactions as Kamal described in the frontline countries. So the major, if you had to just identify one issue, it's the crippling fear of the pull factor. Right, so this is playing out with Orban and others invoking 30, 40 million potential migrants and refugees coming to Europe. So you have this kind of incredibly, this incredible ceiling, and people just don't want to deal with that. And of course, in there, it's not just the millions; it's also the fear of the lone wolf, the terrorist who will come across and cause tremendous damage. For a politician, for a civil servant, that is crippling, the idea that you might enable that to happen. Interestingly, Chancellor Merkel did create a pull factor in late August. We should talk about why she did that. It's really interesting. She knew it was going to happen. And as a result, we've seen an increased flow of people across the European borders. Another, I think, reason for the inaction is that Europe has focused on silver bullet policies, right? So back in April, we're going to save everyone at sea, which it should have been doing years ago. That worked. And that was a successful silver bullet policy on a humanitarian level. The number of people dying in the Mediterranean plunged. But then there were two other policies. One you might not even remember because it was the headlines in May and June, which was a military mission in the Mediterranean, which was going to throttle the smugglers, disrupt their business model, and it was all going to get better. Well, May and June were spent trying to convince the Security Council to act, and what happened? It wasn't because smugglers were using a failed state to get refugees and asylum seekers through to Europe that the crisis had started, because in the end they went through Turkey, right? Mm-hmm. Turkey's not a failed state. So that thesis failed. The second thesis was that we were going to solve the problem through relocation. We're going to take people arriving in Greece and Italy, and we're going to relocate them elsewhere. That is, I think, an important piece of the answer, but it's taken 5 months, and we're still not there, and we're nowhere near the realization of that policy. One of the thoughts I have about this is that because the other side, the one that opposes having a generous policy towards asylum seekers, has a very simplistic set of arguments. They can just say, we're going to put up tents, we're protecting Europe from a Muslim invasion. They're very simple ideas. There might be this need from the more progressive side to come up with very simplistic solutions, too. So relocation is going to solve it, or we're going to have some other big idea. And we're not, because the solution to this is more complex, and it's going to be a series of actions. First is going to be support to frontline states. Second is going to be a real burden-sharing system in Europe with a single asylum agency. Third is going to be support to the grassroots, because the grassroots are the ones that have provided both the moral and the operational leadership in this crisis. The refugees welcome, the groups all over Europe that have been welcoming refugees, and in the United States traditionally over the course of decades, those groups are the ones that need to be supported. And then there needs to be a global response. All that is very complex. It takes diplomacy, it takes policy planning, it takes a lot of effort which hasn't been made. Plus the scale of support, the scale of these policies is way off. We need to be spending something on the order of $20 billion in the frontline states. We're spending a tiny fraction of that. We need to be spending probably on the order of $30 billion in Europe per year to resettle and integrate asylum seekers and refugees at a large scale. We're nowhere near that. So right now we have, and this is my final point, to generate an international response. Kamal mentioned tomorrow there is a side event, a meeting at the United Nations, which will, against all expectations, become the most high-profile event on migration in the UN's history. There are 40-plus heads of state, foreign ministers who will be speaking tomorrow. That wasn't expected, but everybody is looking for some focus of international action. That has to happen, but it will be met with a lot of resistance. There is resistance from the frontline states now. There's a kind of jaundiced distrust of the European Union. If you talk to people in Turkey and Jordan and Lebanon, they're like, where were you all these years? Now you want us to help you because part of the European plan is to try to send people back to these frontline countries or to have processing centers there. And these countries are saying, you know, we've been here for many years. You haven't picked it up. We're not going to help you now. Europe blames the United States. You hear that a lot. It's not as public most of the time, but privately, European politicians think the U.S. has, A, caused a lot of the problem, and B, has not pulled its weight. The rest of the world blames, on those same terms, both Europe and the United States. There are countries, Russia, China, Saudi, which are gaining a strategic advantage out of the situation. So they are also not so keen to see international action. But there has to be international action. I think that you need to have a kind of grand bargain where you have already the frontline states doing what they're doing, Europe finally pulling its weight, and then the international community being the third part of that triangle instead of being this kind of circular firing squad, which it is right now. And collectively, they have to significantly increase, I mean massively increase, both the resettlement or temporary protection numbers, aid to frontline states. You can't go to war and spend trillions of dollars and then say that, I'm sorry to say this, Simon, but $4 billion is not a significant amount given the scale of the problem. Those numbers need to be increased. And eventually you need to have that conversation about Syria and the Mediterranean lead to a conversation about the global protection system, which is now straining and breaking. People don't really have the memory of what happened in World War II anymore. There's not, if you speak with politicians and policymakers, loyalty to that system. That system's capacity has to be increased, in part because it's a humanitarian issue, but also for political reasons. If the burden of protecting refugees is shared globally, you will at least on the margins increase the motivation for countries around the world to help solve conflicts. Absent global burden sharing, it's Europe's problem or it's the US's problem. Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. We'll turn now to... Thank you. Alar Olyan from European Union, but speaking in his personal capacity.
Thank you very much. Yes, I'm still an employee of the European External Action Service, so I cannot avoid answering some of the questions that came up around the EU, but certainly here I'm as a visiting fellow. I'm supposed to be an independent academic, so please take my comments as such and not as an official representative of the EU position. First, let me say that this question is not one that I have dealt with professionally in a very detailed way. So I very much respect the expertise of the other panelists here on the question of resettlement and refugees and migration. But as a European and as a European official, certainly it has been one of the issues that has been front and center, and certainly in my own career in the last 4.5 years dealing with this region, the Syrian crisis and all of the events that have followed and all of the regional impacts of that crisis has certainly been one of the things that has occupied a lot of my bandwidth personally and those of my colleagues. I'm the child of refugees. My parents fled Estonia when the Soviet Union occupied the country at the end of the Second World War. They were first welcomed by Sweden, which is also now with Syrian refugees, proving that it's still very opening, despite the fact that you have a rising populist right-wing anti-migration party, which you have, unfortunately, in several European countries nowadays. After some years there, and they saw that the situation would not change. They had hoped that in 2 years they would be able to go back. They didn't. I mean, they saw in 4 or 5 years that the Cold War division of Europe, the Iron Curtain, had come down. They went on to Canada and found a place of refuge there where, like the United States, Canada's also been very welcoming of immigrants. Europeans have been the source of refugees and migration over hundreds of years. The United States and Canada are evidence of that, but other parts of the world as well. And I think it behooves Europeans, when looking at now becoming the recipient of refugees, that we in the past have been a source of refugees. That said, specifically on the topic of Syria, I think that for me, it's surprising that we are surprised that now we've been hit by an influx and a surge of refugees from Syria. In fact, I was surprised that this didn't happen much earlier, seeing the huge burden which has been placed not only on Turkey, but even more proportionately on Jordan and Lebanon. I think it's a surprise that this didn't happen much earlier, in fact. And I think what Kemal said at the beginning, despair is really the key here. Like my parents who left Sweden, not because Sweden was not welcoming and a good place to stay, but because they saw that there was no chance to return in the near future. I understand very much that the Syrians would want to come to Europe. And unfortunately, you're quite correct that Europe has not been shining in its response to this crisis. But I think there are a number of reasons for that, and I would also defend Europe, that Europe has actually made some progress over the last 5 months. In fact, I think it's quite exceptional that there was a decision taken by a qualified majority against the wishes of 4 member states to effect the relocation. And it did not mean that 5 months, nothing happened since this policy was first proposed by the Commission. It was never accepted by member states because there was a, like always in European Union, there's the first impulses to have a consensus and not to force decisions on a minority by the majority. In this case, the situation went so far that the majority did feel finally that it had to set the precedent, and the relocation, at least it's beginning now. There's many more to come, I'm sure. And this is just the start of it. But I think it's a wake-up call for Europe also in other respects, that certainly the assistance to Turkey and the other frontline states needs to be redoubled, and that has been recognized. However, it's still not going to prevent a continued inflow to Europe. So it's, I think, not only a logistical and financial challenge, but also a cultural and political challenge, because Europe has in history never been a recipient for, it's never been a country of migrants, of refugees coming in from outside of Europe. And I think it's really necessary not only to see the negative side of that, but as Kemal mentioned, there is a positive side even in Turkey with receiving Turkish, receiving the refugees from Syria, but also with regard to Europe. There's been some very interesting arguments put forth that Europe should actually have a much more positive agenda here, looking at our demographic trends over the next 10 to 20 years. The European population is aging. We need an influx. If we cannot increase the birth rate, we need an influx of young people. And many of these Syrian refugees are young, they're educated, they're very willing to work and want to work and to contribute to society. Now, the question is, do we have the leadership on the European side to make that cultural shift happen, to see this paradigm shift from being a country or a region that has not, that has been the source of migrants and not been the receiver of migrants for many years? This is an open question. I hope that this will happen. I think I see signs of it. Germany was mentioned here, that Germany has taken the initiative, and I think it's very heartening to see that not only on the government level, but on the grassroots level. We see a lot of NGOs, communities opening up, even individuals, you know, showing by example. My own country of origin, Estonia, also, there's been a very difficult debate in Estonia, like most of the other Central and Eastern European countries, whether or not it's our time also to open up and do the right thing to accept more refugees. And I think that discussion is still ongoing. It's certainly not been completed in any of those countries, but I think it's heartening that Poland and Estonia, the other Baltic countries, with the exception of these 4 who voted against, have accepted that there is a need and have taken the lead and have taken hits politically to stand out there and say, yes, we have to be part of this burden sharing. Sometimes it's not only a idealistic or altruistic policy, because from the Estonian perspective, for example, we know that we have also a very potentially unstable situation going on towards our east. Ukraine has not been mentioned here except in the context of, you know, these multiple crises hitting Europe. But eventually, what would happen if there would be a meltdown in Ukraine or, God forbid, in Russia, and there would be a huge influx of refugees? And if Estonia did not stand up now and say we are going to help our southern member state brothers and sisters now, why would they come and help us in 5 or 10 years if we face a similar influx from the east? So I agree there's a real need to set up the infrastructure and put more money there. George Soros has come up with some very ideas, very interesting ideas about putting out bonds and raising money through bonds to finance this 10 or 20 billion that you probably are very correct to say this is needed, both in terms of helping the frontline states and also to help the resettlement policy within Europe. I think Europe is quite often blamed for things that we are not really worthy of being blamed of. And certainly, I don't want to get into the blame game here, but certainly I have not heard any serious accusations towards the United States that it's the United States' fault. Perhaps individual politicians have done so, but I think in terms of Syria, it's definitely a global responsibility and a global failure. Of course, it's on Europe's footstep and our doorstep, but it's certainly not only Europe's responsibility or Europe's capability. And I think one of the things which has happened now as well, perhaps partly because of the Russian move into Syria, but it's also, I think, perhaps innocently, naively, I can say this, that it's partly the positive result of the Iran nuclear deal, that Iran can be seen as a responsible partner, a stakeholder, someone to talk to, and the Russians, so that the discussion about Syria's future has to include all of the stakeholders, all of those who are rightly or wrongly invested in the Syria conflict, either in manipulating it or in trying to resolve it and find a new way to make an international politically agreed solution to the crisis. Because as was said by yourself, Beth, in the beginning, there is no humanitarian solution. There's only a political solution to this. And here, Europe, I think, has been very consistent from the beginning. We've been supporting the UN, the special envoys. Just yesterday and the day before in New York, my boss, High Representative Vice President Mogherini, was meeting with the special envoy and bringing him together with some of the European foreign ministers and as well the foreign ministers of EU, US, Russia, and China. So I'm hopeful that if we see a Geneva III on the horizon, that third time we'll be lucky and it will produce a political result that would be welcomed not only by the international community, but by the Syrian people who have been too long suffering from this conflict. Turkey is a very special partner of Europe. It is an accession country. Let's remind us, it is still officially on the way to becoming a full member of the EU, even if the process has been stalled. And as such, I think Turkey and Europe have a special responsibility together to make a resolution of this problem. Next week, the summit of Turkey and the EU will take place in Brussels, and I'm sure that a number of these issues with regard to helping Turkey, but also in terms of the safe zones, in terms of the issue with the PKK and the Kurdish separatists will come up and will not be resolved, but certainly will be very difficult matters to discuss. Certainly, I'm from my perspective, I would hope that we would see not only this cultural shift in mindset going on in Europe, but also in neighboring countries. And I'm thinking here of the Balkans and Turkey as well as being some of those countries that have been hardest hit by the Syria refugee crisis. I would have a few other things to say as well, but I'm conscious of the time, and I'd like to see more of the discussion take place. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much, Alan. Thanks to all of our panelists, also for your brevity, because we do have time for questions from the audience. But before doing so, I'm going to just ask each of you if you would like to gaze into your crystal balls and think, what's going to happen? Where are we going to be in a year?
mean, are we going to still see the continued outflow, a hemorrhaging of people from Syria? Or will the international community or the Europeans, the Americans, manage a response that somehow promotes the rights of those displaced and deals with... Greg, you want to go first?
So I think, thanks. I think that you will start to see action even as soon as tomorrow towards a more collective global response on this issue. I think a year from now, I can't predict what will happen in terms of the peace process or the lack of one. I don't think it will have a material impact, at least in a positive way, on the flows. I think you will start building a what we saw in the 70s and 80s for Vietnam, a more of a comprehensive plan of action for Syrian refugees. The times are different today. It's not going to be as, I think, muscular as that response was back then when the U.S. at the time was taking, I think, 14,000 Vietnamese refugees every month. But I do think that you'll start to see something that is more collective and global in nature. And in part, it's going to be, you know, I think you're right to say that things have been done. I would just argue too slowly and too small a scale. But I think Europe, the world will wait for Europe to act more ambitiously. But I think that that is starting to take place.
Others?
No crystal ball. But what needs to be done is greater global commitment to supporting refugees in the region. I hope we will see that some movement that way later this week and more importantly, as the year progresses.
I think that's something that Turkey in particular has been emphasizing, spending over $7 billion and I think less than $400 million in international assistance. Alar or Kamal, you want to jump in?
Well, I'd like to take up what Alar mentioned, the blame game. And I feel, as a citizen of Turkey, I feel I have the luxury to take a bit of a critical position on Turkey. It goes without saying that Turkey has taken a very positive approach to it. It gets recognized across the board internationally. But I think Turkey has a very important role to play in the collective effort that Greg has made references to. And what is critical there is for Turkish leadership to stop playing the blame game. Yes, I agree with Alar that Europe has not come forward. And as Greg, you pointed out, there is resentment towards there. Where were you? But that's the past. And this is an opportunity for Turkey to take a positive step and try to revive that soft power image it used to have until a few years ago. This is how I would like Turkey to start to act from tomorrow.
I don't have a crystal ball, but certainly one aspect of this which hasn't been really touched on is that already now this crisis is not just a Syrian crisis.
Right.
We touched upon, you know, the issue of refugees in the neighboring countries, but also the spread and the conflagration of this conflict towards Iraq. And the fact that Europe has seen this now as a regional conflagration and doesn't see it purely and simply as one which is limited to Syria. There was a strategy on dealing with Syria, Iraq, and Daesh, or ISIL, as you call it here. And that is still being looked at how to implement that, but already the first money has been set aside to deal with it as a regional strategy. So I think we already see that this has become something which is not only limited to Syria, which is not only limited to Syrian actors, but very much has the flavor and the indication of a proxy war. And I think I mentioned that regional stakeholders have to be involved, and that is also taking responsibility for not further inflaming for their own political or geopolitical causes. And that includes Turkey, that includes Saudi Arabia, Iran, now Russia, United States, Europe, many different players. Israel is looking very nervously at what is happening on the Golan Heights and what could happen in Syria with regard to its access now with Russia now becoming involved. There are a number of complications here, and I'm afraid that this crisis could really, unless it's contained and dealt with properly, result in a regional conflagration, which would mean not only tens and hundreds of thousands of refugees coming to Europe, but millions. And this is really an impetus for us to all of us to take a responsibility and to make sure that this remains high on the agenda of our own countries and organizations, but also of the globe as a whole.
Thanks to all of you for somewhat sobering assessments there. Let's take some questions. I think we'll take three or four and then give the panelists an opportunity to respond. We have microphones. We'll start here. One, two, three, four, five. And if you could please identify yourself. We'll start in the first row up here.
Thank you.
Can you stand up, please?
Sure. Thank you. Matteo Garavaglia, Center for United States and Europe. I work on the European bit, on the European side of this crisis. Now, I have a question, and I think this has to do with governance. And I would like to, first of all, make sure that we don't talk about Europe as such. There's not such a thing as Europe. There are EU member states, and there are European institutions. And I think this is a question of governance because so far we had too often EU member states trying to play a role here, whilst these member states are not able to play a role to handle effectively the migration crisis. This has been apparent for a number of, not even months, a number of years. And indeed, for a number of years, since the Juncker Commission took over, the Commission has been pushing forward a number of proposals to handle this on a pan-European, supranational level, so through the EU institutions as opposed to the member states, through the Parliament, the Council, the Commission, and the European External Action Service. Indeed, I think it is extremely interesting to observe that things have started moving when everything got out of control, and on the 22nd of September, through qualified majority voting, the European Union had to push its own decision onto some member states. And now the Commission has come up with a number of proposals that had already presented months ago and that were shot down by the member states. And these proposals are being taken up this time, strengthening Frontex in a number of ways, doing a number of things to have a more coherent approach to asylum policy. So my question there, I could go on forever, but is the following. From the US point of view, what do U.S. representatives that deal with these issues. We have one on the panel to put him on the spot here. What can they do to strengthen the role of supranational institutions, therefore the Council, the Commission, and so on, vis-a-vis the member states? How can you privilege having a relationship with supranational institutions as opposed to the member states? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We'll have the next gentleman here.
I'm Cesare Merlini. I'm the non-resident senior fellow here at the Center for United States and Europe at Brookings. My question addresses instead the sociological composition of refugees. Mm. We tend to make a mix of refugees, but they are very different. And I would like to underline in particular the difference between the waves that come from Syria and those who come from Libya or through Libya. It seems to me that this is important because if you do this sociological breakdown, you will see that there are very serious problems related to the problem of relocation, integration, education, and so on and so forth. But I would like also to, not only sociological, but also cultural and religious. Where we stand on the analysis of this problem, I'm not sure I have seen this illuminating. One point of detail, there have been waves of refugees in the past. What is new in this one? Well, I'm struck by the pictures. You see these people coming out of these boats, starving, dehydrated, and they hold a cell phone. Is it relevant? Are we considering this problem? I understand that smugglers do take advantage of communication. Do we? Thank you.
Thank you. We'll have Maureen and one, two. And if you could please be brief, we have a number of people who want to ask questions.
Yeah. My name is Henar Maruf. I'm from Kurdistan, the Kurdish part of Iraq. My question is about the effect of the refugees in non-state actors. as a developing country as Kurdistan. So what, because you have been talking about Europe as a developed country and you're talking about the effects and the consequences of refugees being hosted in such countries, but what about a non-state country, a non-state region, sorry, which is a developing country, what will be the effects of refugees to such places? Thank you so much.
Thank you, Maureen, and then the gentleman here.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Sajjad. I am an author, actually, and I also teach in the Islamic schools in Bangladesh. My mother and two young sisters were refugees, and I volunteered as a worker in the refugee camps in 1971. We had 9.8 million refugees who crossed over to Bangladesh. 96% came back to Bangladesh. We control our own refugee camps. We didn't have no administrators there. And the money problem was not there with us. We had very less money to leave, but there was discipline in the camps. This could be a case study for all of you gentlemen, because we successfully brought the people back to our country, and Indians had no complaint after that the refugees stayed back. How we did it is some of the things that we can discuss with you, and I can share my knowledge with you because I was involved in that situation for 9 months. Further, all asylum seekers are not refugees. I teach in the Islamic schools. I hear a lot of whispers. There are Afghan people who have lined up near German border. Are they Talibans? We don't know. How many IS has gone into those camps? We don't know. What are the systems that will prevent violence to erupt? We already had 2005 and 2007 violence in France and 2011 violence in England. And what you all know about, your next generation will face the violence again if you don't handle the situation today. And if you want me to suggest to you how we control the camps in 1971, we can share it with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. The last question on this round, Maureen, and then we'll take another round.
Thank you. Maureen White, I'm a senior fellow at SICE and a former State Department official. I want to bring up the issue of safe havens in what I call the ghost of Srebrenica. It kind of reminds me of President Clinton reading the book Balkan Ghosts and deciding those people had always been at war, so don't get involved. We talk about safe havens. People mention Srebrenica. Didn't work. Don't do it. The fact of the matter is we know some of the reasons Srebrenica failed, and we know some of the things that we can do better in a safe haven. In Srebrenica, the peacekeepers were not armed and had no mandate nor ability to intervene when faced with aggression. When we talk about safe havens in Syria, and I was at a conference last weekend in which David Petraeus made his case and made it strongly, and it was endorsed by, amongst others, Bill Burns, Bob Gates, John McCain, and the head of the British Intelligence Unit. So safe havens in Syria would include, as they're currently being discussed, some kind of armed prevention group inside of Syria, and also no-fly zone. So with these kind of additions to the framework of institutionalizing safe havens, isn't there justified reason in giving it more serious consideration?
Okay, thank you. We have a number of questions here, one on U.S. efforts to strengthen supranational institutions in Europe, one on the sociological composition of the current trend of refugees, one on the impact of Kurdistan and developing countries who are hosting large numbers of displaced people, security issues for refugees, and the always interesting issue of safe havens. Who'd like to jump in?
Well, I guess I have to jump in for the U.S. supporting EU institutions, though I'm going to do it a little bit poorly, I'm afraid. It's not my area of specialty. I just see a piece of that. Certainly, number one, obviously the EU is well-developed part of the world. It knows how to do things itself. We're not here to sort of steer them or tell them or provide financial support on how to get things done. But we do have very close relations on humanitarian issues. We and the Europeans together, particularly EU institutions, are the largest humanitarian donors in the world, and we work very closely on policy issues. So I think where we can help is working with our European counterparts and talking about policies and helping them establish the policies necessary to deal with the problem. There are a lot of discussions that go on along those lines. And just a little bit on the edges, we do also have some expertise among some of our institutions with law enforcement, Coast Guard, and other areas, which we can share and do share with the Europeans.
Other responses? Yes, please, Alar.
Yeah, I think there was a very pessimistic view of Europe presented here by my colleague to my left regarding the future of EU integration. I think if you look at the history of EU integration, it has always, almost always preceded via crises. We've had to have a crisis where there was no other alternative but to find a pan-European solution. And now I would say that we are in that situation now once again, to have a common asylum policy, that it makes no sense to have 28 different asylum policies. How do you define who is a refugee, who is a migrant, and so on? How do you do the registration and all of this infrastructural part and the legal and technical part that should now is realized. There is a common realization it should be done in a pan-European way, also with regard to the guarding of our borders. If we're going to have a Schengen zone where there's a continued border-free Europe, the vast majority are members of Schengen. A couple of have opt-outs, but most are in, and those who are not in want to get in. If we're going to have that survive, we're going to need a common guarding also of the borders with a common policy there. If I may respond just on the sociological aspect, that reminded me to actually dispute another claim that you made, was that we had this policy towards the refugee influx from Libya, and now they went to Syria. I mean, those are completely different questions. The mass of the migrants and refugees who came via Libya through the sea to Europe, and many unfortunately died doing, they were from sub-Saharan Africa for the most part. And they were brought in through human trafficking gangs, and I mean, that is one aspect that is not connected to the Syria crisis. The only connection is that both are failing states and plagued by conflict, and there's a breakdown of law and order in both territories, in Libya and Syria. Certainly, I don't agree that there is this. I think that is the what you said about the danger of not being able to integrate these different cultural and you didn't say it, but I mean, I will say it, the Muslim minority in Europe, the attacks that happened in France this last year, they were not, the fresh refugees and migrants coming from these areas. They were quite often had been two and three generations and had not been successfully integrated into those societies. And I think if you look at the profile of, and now the two-thirds at least of those who have come through the surge, the sevenfold increase in migrants that have come via Turkey to Greece and Italy are from Syria. And most of those are highly educated. They're in the prime of life, and they have a huge positive impact, potentially, if they are resettled and they're allowed to work, allowed to put their kids in school and to integrate with the society. It's a huge loss for Syria if they remain in Europe, but it's a big gain for Europe. And we have to make that clear to the European electorate. As regards I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Others who'd like to respond?
Sure. So let me just take on a couple of things that Alar said, and then a couple of the comments that were made. So I'm a dual citizen of Greece and the United States. I'm a believer in Europe. I'd like to see more Europe, not less Europe. I bridle at this notion that, oh, well, Europe just advances through crisis. Well, it does advance through crisis, but with great damage. And the question is, why do you need to create that damage in order to get to the next step? Maybe it'll work. Maybe it'll work. Maybe in 5 years we'll look back and say, oh, what a relief, we managed to pull it off. It's possible. I think that's what Chancellor Merkel is trying to do. I think there's a bit of shock therapy in her opening up the borders of Germany to try to compel Europe to confront the idea that it is going to be a country of immigration in the future, and it has to build the public institutions, the schools, the police, and other institutions to integrate people. Yes, the Eastern European countries have come a long way from 5 months ago, but the damage that's done in that process of allowing it to be done chaotically is quite excessive. So I think that's what I'm contesting. The refugee flows into Europe through Italy earlier on in the year had a very significant minority who were Syrians. So yes, you're right that there were sub-Saharan Africans coming through, but there were also many Syrians, and those went over to a different route. So I think that that's, we don't have to get into the details of that. Safe zones, I think every possibility has to be on the table at this point, because not only is the current situation big, but it is potentially gonna be much bigger. And you have to have a comprehensive plan that takes into consideration, okay, what about a scenario where there are 10 million people trying to reach Europe, or 10 million people who are refugees in the region? How are you going to sit down with your various partners and say, this is what we're going to do? Something that you alluded to, 9.8 million in the 70s. The question of terrorism comes up. Simon can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that the U.S. has resettled around 700,000 refugees in the past 10 years?
Yes, about.
Of those 700,000, two have been identified to have links from a single case in Kentucky to a terrorist group without having caused any damage to American interests. So absolutely it's a concern, and one case of terrorism could upend public opinion. But whether you're from ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you don't have to come in through the Greek islands. You're probably not going to. You can probably find other safer ways to do it. But nonetheless, it's a sort of parallel and separate issue that we have to be careful not to conflate in order to be able to also have a humanitarian policy. I'll leave it at that.
If I could just add on the terrorism issue, I think we have to remember that refugees are victims of terrorism. And our job is to protect them from that terrorism. There are really very few cases that I'm aware of terrorist infiltration and control of Syrian camps. Certainly would be something that we would be concerned of if it was to happen. That's a separate issue than resettlement. And on resettlement, we like to say that no group of people entering the United States is more screened than Syrian refugees. We take that very seriously and we look very closely. But again, main point here is these are the victims of terrorism.
And also, I mean, just to add to that, which is, you know, if you want to prevent terrorism, you probably don't want to leave several hundred thousand or a million Syrian children uneducated in Jordan and Lebanon for a few years, angry at the rest of the world because the rest of the world didn't help them. That's probably a much better generator of terrorism than accepting
Absolutely.
Them through resettlement.
Absolutely. That's why we concentrate on education for children. We didn't talk about the safe haven
right.
zone. Would you?
Safe havens?
Yeah, we'll do.
Yeah.
I can't hear you.
The non-state actors. Destination.
Well, okay, let me comment on both non-state actors. And also, I think what the part of your question I remember is developing countries dealing with refugees. Most refugees in the world are in seeking refuge in developing countries. This is common. And the issues are actually much the same. The ability to work, education, and health. And those are all the same questions that are going to be looked at any country in which refugees flee to. So I'm not sure. There are different issues for the country itself and each individual country, but Uganda, Kenya, Malaysia, Thailand are all countries with large populations of refugees and have dealt with them in different ways. I think you have to look at camp refugees different than non-camp refugees. More and more of the world's refugee population comes from the non-camp urban refugees. They're often referred to about three-quarters, I think, of the world's refugee population. And they have certain needs. And, I always focus on education, well, protection beyond everything else. But after that, education, health, and work. If refugees can work, then they can support themselves, and there's a much less burden on the state. If their children are educated, they're more likely to stay out of trouble and become productive members of society. And health, obviously, people's health is provided for there well. On safe havens, I don't think anyone would argue. Well, very few people would argue against safe havens, which had a solid, dependable ground security force. The problem is that most of the safe haven suggestions that have come forth lately don't even mention ground forces. They mention air power and humanitarian support. That's not a safe haven. If you don't have some sort of legitimate security force on the ground, refugees are not going to want to voluntarily return, and those that do are not going to be safe. The few proposals I've seen that do mention ground forces are nonspecific about where they would come from. But that being said, speaking personally, I'm certainly open to any suggestions and proposals which show a solid security ground force providing protection.
Thanks. I think we'll take some more questions back here. We're running out of time. This woman right here, one, two, three. Just please, if you could stand up and identify yourself.
Yeah, hello. Emily Epke from the EU delegation here in DC. I would like to ask the practical side of it regarding the selection process. So we have indeed in the European Union the problem of selection today, not only in Germany, but most of the member states are advancing the question how there is a need of selecting refugees because of education and relocation, resettlement. How could we do that? Thank you.
Very clear. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. My name is Kale Agassi from TÜŞİAD, Turkish Business and Industry Association. I am based in Brussels. So very rapid observations, ending with a question, of course. Certainly these flow of refugees are different from those coming from at the beginning or end of the 19th century or the beginning of the 20th century from Central Europe or Russia through Ellis Island to United States or those who went to Australia. But nomadism, the nomadic culture, this mobility in space has always been an engine of progress in the societies. This is not only a mobility in space, but also in time because of the demography. These are young people coming to an old continent. So there is this space-time continuum of mobility, and there is also virtual mobility because for the first time, a wave of refugee crisis is happening also on the in a field which is really energized by the mobile technologies and connections, and so it's a different flow of refugee problem, certainly, and it's not only refugees escaping violence, but also seeking a better social and economic future in Europe. It's about quality also. However, on the quantity side, it is still so important because the numbers are so overwhelming that how to tangle between this qualitative part and the quantitative part is certainly a major question. And second part of the problem is also in relation with your excellent report. Congratulations, by the way, for that. Challenges for Turkey. Well, there are lots of problems in Turkey. There are lots of failures in today's Turkey, certainly. However, there are some points of positive developments, hope. So, one is maybe paradoxically will come from Europe itself, as you said. Europe can go in a dialectical way out of this crisis with further progress, further reform, better managing its variable geometry, and then getting ready for future enlargements because there will be two different circles, Eurozone and wider Europe maybe. So two circles, two speed, multiple dimensional Europe. So that can be good for Turkey. But as for Turkey, the Cyprus problem can be a good news, not only for Turkey, but for the West in general. The only potential good news in this region, if it happens, if there is a solution in Cyprus. And the third point, which is potentially positive, Turkey is going to elections in 1st of November. There are more than 2 million refugees, and none of the political parties are provoking a demagogic discourse about the refugee problem in Turkey. This is very interesting, and it's happening now. So, Jean-Claude Juncker, when he delivered his speech, so-called State of the Union speech before the European Parliament, out of his text, you know, in his speech only, he referred to the problem of the list of unsafe countries of origin. And if, he said, some countries are in that list, they will no longer be eligible for EU membership. So we are a little bit confused because whether Turkey will be a safe country of origin, unsafe country of origin, because the Prime Minister of Luxembourg and the Foreign Minister of Luxembourg also said that for them, Turkey, with all this violence with the PKK, can no longer be considered a safe country. So my question is how to make sure that once more Turkey's EU process has that transformational force with its all conditionalities, engaging Turkey in such a way that all these challenges stemming from the refugee crisis are managed accordingly with the common European interests, including those of Turkey. Thank you.
Thank you. Last question here.
Thank you, Kamal, and to the panel and to Brookings for hosting this important event. My name is Tanyel Kushakchin from the Armenian Assembly of America. I have a brief comment and then a question for you all. You know, one of the tiny countries that is having a big impact in a region that hasn't been mentioned today is Armenia. Many people consider that the last Christian safe haven in the region. And of the 20,000 refugees that Armenia has already accepted, the majority of them are the most vulnerable, religious minorities, Assyrians, Yazidis, and Armenians from Aleppo, which once housed about 100,000 Armenians, mostly descendants of the 1915 Armenian genocide, have now seeking refuge in Armenia again. And in fact, the Karabakh government has built a whole new city called New Aleppo, where over 10,000 of the Syrian Armenians will have new apartments, shopping malls, etc. So there are, tiny countries in the region that are making a big impact, such as Armenia. But I just wanted to mention that briefly. My question is, Brookings alumnus and White House alumnus Philip Gordon recently wrote in Politico that, quote, the essential problem with U.S.-Syria policy since the start of the crisis has been the mismatch between objectives and means. The objective of displacing the Assad regime has proven unachievable with the means we have been willing or able to deploy to achieve it. To correct this mismatch, we have two options: increase the means with whatever costs and consequences might accompany doing so, or modify the objectives. Now, I want to get your response to that as we see perhaps a shift in U.S. policy and what impact that would have on refugees in the region. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. We've got three very broad-ranging questions, one on the selection process, one particularly on Turkey, EU, and so on, and a third on the larger political strategic interest of dealing with Syria. Anybody want to jump in and perhaps 90 seconds each?
I'll just do the selection. I mean, clearly, for relocation to succeed, there needs to be a selection process that's mutual, right? So asylum seekers and refugees have preferences. Countries have preferences. There's absolutely no problem, in my view, for those preferences to be accommodated to the degree possible. There's been a lot of fuss about countries in the East saying that they won't accept certain asylum seekers. Part of that might be racist. It might constitute discrimination, but partly it's also out of an instinct that certain countries don't have experience with integration. They have institutions, for instance, the church, which could be an engine of integration, or schools that have language programs that would suit some students and not others. So there is absolutely nothing wrong with biasing preferences if you can try to match those two up. I think part of the problem with the EU's proposal going back to the EU agenda was that it didn't have any of those nuances, that there was this distribution key that was announced that had just hard numbers based on four criteria and didn't seem to take those issues into account. And the obvious sort of concern there as well, if you relocate people against their will to places that don't want them, they're going to leave. So I think it's a crucial issue, and it is one that's being discussed a lot.
Kamal, you want to take some of the questions on Turkey?
Yeah. I mean, they were all great comments and questions, and I wish we had time to respond to them all. I just wanted to, the EU-Turkey and refugee crisis triangle is a very, very interesting one, and that's where I'm in total agreement with all that Simon has said, but disappointed that when he responded to Matteo's question about EU institutions and the hand that the US could give, I really thought you were going to say you have to make Turkey a member of the European Union, and then the future would be a very pinkish one.
I prefer to keep my current state of employment. Thank you.
But there, I personally believe that the ball is in Turkey's court. The current government could use this as an opportunity to take very constructive steps towards working with the European Union on this particular matter. And the rest would naturally flow out of it. The very good question, earlier question on sociological aspect of this current crisis and the future, I really think we need to put a lot more thinking in, into it. I think we're going through a period where identities are becoming very important for societies, countries, and there is a polarization process that is occurring at the same time. We see it right in this country as the debate on the upcoming presidential elections expands, and our identity immigration issues plays a very important role. I think a challenge is awaits there. On Armenia and the Kurdish regional government, I think, yes, there are two little countries out there who have been carrying a burden that is not receiving the recognition they do. But forgive me, I think publicly declaring that refugees from Syria are being settled in Karabakh could trigger controversies. I personally would like Armenia to also give a helping hand to Yazidi refugees who have been scattered out in the region, given this old tradition of Yazidi communities in Armenia too. One last point about safe havens. I agree 100% with what Simon has said and also Maureen, but I have deep down in me a fear that safe havens, unless take the shape that Simon has made references to, whose likelihood I see as tiny, may become a source of even greater problems in terms of human suffering and humanitarian challenges. I fear it could get politically abused, given that today in the region there are countries who, on the one hand, are trying to give a helping hand to the humanitarian crisis there through funds and other programs, but at the same time are following political policies that are aggravating the situation there. And I feel safe havens may fall into that trap. Thanks.
Yes, final comment? Yes, please.
Two quick points on resettlement in the United States. We pick our cases based on an effort to have the greatest impact in the countries of first refuge, the most we can do to help them. So we look for vulnerable cases. We take cases with medical problems, which can't be handled in the country of first refuge. We take cases of female-headed families. We take cases of victims of torture and rape and other abuse. And we take cases of people who are not safe even in the country of first refuge. Mm-hmm. That's not necessarily true. Let me give an example of that outside the Syrian example. In Africa, where you have some refugees who have fled violence, they're safe from the violence, but if they're, say, LGBT, they may not be safe in the camp that they've arrived in. So we'll take cases like that. And I also wanted to make one last comment. Two or three people mentioned cell phones and the ability for refugees, and I think this is also true for migrants, to communicate. I think that's making a radical change in the way that people move, that the ability for someone to go back to their family and say, I've reached X and it's great, or this is how you get on this route, is really accelerating the ability of people to move and changing the way they communicate.
Alain?
Very briefly, if I may, just on 3 points quickly on selection. As I said in the beginning, I'm not an expert on migration and refugee issues, but as I understand, there is a difference legally between a refugee who is qualified to be a refugee and who is a migrant who is leaving not because of repression or war, but for economic reasons. And I know that's a very contentious issue, how to define that, but I think as far as I understand, a refugee, by international law, you have to accept, and then it's a question of the first country and where to resettle and burden sharing, et cetera. But I think in the Syria case, and as I have been understanding, part of the surge into Europe has not only been Syrians. I said about two-thirds, but I listened to an interview the other day with an Afghan family, and they were saying how much it's become more difficult now, that they are a bit jealous of their Syrian brothers who are getting easier access to asylum, and they say, well, this is a new war, and we're coming from an old war, but it's still a war zone. So let's not forget that there are those as well. On the question of the safe havens, I'm also very uncomfortable with this discussion. You know, Srebrenica, of course, is a warning, but even if it was a warning, I still don't see any possibility of doing this without a UN sanction. I don't see any UN sanction coming realistically with members of the Security Council being at odds over the future of Syria and the regime in Syria. So if there is a unilateral move by Turkey and the US or whatever, I mean, it's very hypothetical at this point, but I think there's a huge danger not only of not achieving the goals of protecting the civilians, but also of, in fact, spurring the partition and destruction of the Syrian state, participating in that. And that we have to see. You were talking about, you know, looking into the future, and I think the danger of a partition of Syria is very real and very dangerous. And the discussion about safe havens have to be seen also in that context. Thank you.
Well, thanks to the panelists for an illuminating discussion, although it's clear that we could have gone a couple more hours in terms of the complexity of issues here. And thanks to all of you for coming.